I am of the belief, and this again comes from my experience as both a person of faith and as a scholar of religions, that there really actually is no such thing as religion without culture. That you can't really point to a thing called Islam that exists in a vacuum outside of its interaction with culture.
On In Good Faith, we believe that all faith traditions have something to teach us about how God is working in the world and in our lives. So join us as we listen and learn and discover how speaking with people of other faiths can strengthen our own faith and even our own practice. Have you ever had the chance to look back on one of your accomplishments and rethink how you might do something differently today? I think we all have, whether we're a parent or a CEO or an artist. Our circumstances change, we learn more, we understand other people better, and we realize, though, we may have done well 10 or 15 years ago, we have some different ideas now than we did then. My guest today is Reza Aslan, writer, commentator, professor, Emmy and Peabody-nominated producer, and scholar of religions. This year, Random House has just reissued a 20th anniversary edition of his 2005 No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam. I spoke with Reza Aslan in 2020 about his personal experience with Islam and Christianity. And you can hear that interview in episode 68 of our archive. But today we're sharing Reza's reflections about the 20 years that have passed since the publication of the book that brought him to the attention of many Americans.
When Random House brought up this idea that this book has been in print and it's become the seminal text in learning about Islam, would you like to update it and for like a 20th anniversary edition? And I think what they meant was maybe add a paragraph here or a sentence there. And I went through and I read it, and I hadn't read it in quite some time. And I ended up, I would say, probably rewriting a full third of this book. I mean, it broke the whole thing. They had to start all over again with the index and all of that stuff. Had to record a brand new audio version because everything was different. And it's not as though I intended that, but I think the world was quite different 20 years ago. I myself was quite different 20 years ago. And so the experience of going back and reading this book from a different perspective in a different world was eye-opening. And I think a lot of it was an attempt to update it and bring it up to 2025, but also it was to re-examine some of the assumptions that I had made and to figure out if those assumptions actually turned out to be correct or not. And sometimes they weren't. And so I had to sort of go in. A joke that a friend of mine said is that I stripped all the optimism out of the book because my definition, if you want to write something for posterity, you should probably remove the optimism from it. And I wouldn't say that's necessarily the case, but I did understand his point.
Well, I love something you said right at the very beginning. It's in the preface. If you don't mind me quoting you to you here, it says, Islam is not static. It is not fixed in time. Like all great faith traditions, it is continually shaped and reshaped by the people who practice it. Now, I can hear people thinking, well, no, God makes a revelation and it's timeless. And yet, we're the people who interpret that and live it out in our daily lives. And were you, looking back 20 years later, surprised by changes you've seen?
There are a number of phenomenon that I couldn't have predicted. I mean, one of them was the rise of social media and the way that social media would redefine the very conception of community that we have had as a species for hundreds of thousands of years, right? I mean, for hundreds of thousands of years, the very definition of community meant the people around you. And all of a sudden, it doesn't mean that anymore. And how does that affect not just the way that we think about ourselves and our place in an indeterminate world, how we create our collective identities, but how we understand our faith communities? And so a huge chunk, certainly of the latter part of the book, was updating the way in which social media and the internet has redefined what it means to be part of a religious community. I will say, though, it is really interesting because people have asked me for 20 years, you know, what was the point of this book? And if I were to say in its simplest way, this book is an attempt to remind people that there's nothing special about Islam, that there's nothing all that different and unique about Islam, that Islam, like every religion in the world, has been transformed by history and by politics and by context and by the communities out of which it arose and the communities in which it was implanted. We have this tendency, particularly in the Western world, to think of Islam as different, that it's not like other religions. And frankly, as you rightly point out, Muslims are the most guilty of that sentiment that, you know, oh, there are other religions, but there's Islam and Islam is different. Other religions change, Islam doesn't. Other religions come in varieties, Islam doesn't. Well, that's just nonsense. Hopefully, if anyone got anything out of this book, it was just that simple notion that Islam is fundamentally just a religion like every other religion. Comes in a bunch of flavors, it's constantly in flux, and as you say, it is utterly dependent on the individual for its interpretation.
When you first wrote this book, it was, as you say, just right on the heels of 9/11, so within about 4 years. And I don't know if you felt some sense of, there is so much misunderstanding, let me set the record straight, or at least let's get a few facts established. And then my perception, which could be totally wrong, this is what I'm asking, is that for a while, over a period of decades, there started to feel like a lot of people at least had met a Muslim here in the U.S., and that maybe it was a little more usual to know just the kinds of things that normalize.
I will say it is definitely true that Islam has gone from the front pages to the back pages of our newspapers. It's not at the front of mind the way that it was when I wrote this book. And unquestionably, part of the reason that I wrote this book was to dispel some of the misconceptions and misperceptions that people had about Islam. Now, 20 years later, going back, I did notice, interestingly enough, that so much of the conversations about Islam, and I was just as guilty about this, saw Islam as a geopolitical force and not just as a spiritual faith. And I will say that part of the updating process was to de-emphasize some of the geopolitics that were front of mind for so many readers in 2005 and aren't necessarily front of mind anymore. And so that's a fundamental change. But yeah, in the end, I think truly what has been the most special part about this book is not just the way that it's made non-Muslims no longer afraid of this religion as though it's some bizarre, odd, strange, foreign, and exotic thing, that it's certainly part of the religious fabric of the United States as much as any other religious tradition is. But on top of that, that Muslims, and particularly young Muslims in the wake of 9/11, who were being buffeted by other people's voices about what they believed, who they were, on both sides, the non-Muslim and Muslim, saw in this book a kind of manifesto, a way to connect with what they already felt about their faith and their identity, and now had a language for it, now had a background to it, now had a history that they could point to, facts that they could point to say, this is why I believe the way that I believe. That I did not intend that. I did not expect that. If I were to be perfectly honest, when I started writing this book in 2002, it was for non-Muslims. That's who I was writing this book for. And it was a surprise to me that it became a kind of manifesto for Muslims to say, this is the faith that I actually practice and believe.
You mentioned a little while ago, not foreseeing, because maybe who could, the rise of social media and how anyone can set them up to appear to be an expert on something.
Right.
Even if just by virtue of good lighting or whatever, they may seem more authoritative.
Yeah.
So you talk about this mosque, and this book was the first I'd really heard it described. This is in Egypt. Do you say Al-Azhar?
That's right. Al-Azhar, yes. Mm-hmm.
And that for so long, even though there is no, quote, Pope for Islam, but this was sort of regarded as a highest authority in scriptural interpretation and tradition and understanding. And that social media that's happening, I just wonder if you talk about, obviously you're an intelligent and clever person, so I sort of delighted in your saying, but
one of the countless social media imams, cyber muftis, or digital Muslim influencers who dispense advice on religious and legal matter anywhere from Jakarta to Detroit. And that really is having an effect on the younger generation?
I don't think we're even in a position yet to understand the full effect of it. We're too mired in it right now. But if I were to jump 20 years in time right now and look back, I would say this is the moment in time in which Islam as a global religion utterly transformed. And I know it sounds like an exaggerated thing to say, but it's hard to truly exaggerate what the internet and social media has done to the notion of authority in Islam. You look at a place like Al-Azhar, which is the closest thing that Islam has to a Vatican. It is the center of Islamic learning and has been for more than 1,000 years. It is the fount of legal knowledge in Islam until about a decade ago. And now the truth of the matter is that most, particularly younger Muslims, don't look to the esteemed institutions of Islam with their 1,000-year history and legacy as the source for their understanding of their faith. The truth is that they look to TikTok. And what they find in what I'm referring to as cyber muftis, you know, these sort of digital influencers, these online presences who have taken upon themselves an authority that for 14 centuries rested exclusively in the hands of the clerical institutions and schools of law and Islam, and have now taken that authority for themselves to dispense not just spiritual advice, but juristic declarations about Islamic law, about what is permitted and what is not permitted. And yet, they have no background in Islamic law. They've never studied Al-Azhar or anywhere else at all, but their authority comes, as you note, from a really good stage and nice lighting and an audience. And they are now the sun around which so many young Muslims around the world orbit because they are speaking in a language that those Muslims understand. What is that going to do to the future of Islam? It's too early to say, but the effects are going to be profound.
As a father, what do you feel about that?
I mean, on the one hand, it is nerve-wracking, right? And I could understand why not just parents, but even experts, when they look at the way in which social media is transforming religious communities, not just Islam, obviously, and recreating religious communities from scratch without the foundation, the learning, the traditional bounds of authority, etc., that it could create anxiety.
Like, it's all going to fall apart.
Yeah, the printing press happened and people thought, well, anyone can read the Bible? That's insane. Why would we allow anyone to do that? Then that means anyone can just simply decide what it means. Right, correct. That is what it means. And that, is that such a bad thing? Maybe not. So I actually maintain a much more positive view towards the role that social media and the internet is having, particularly on the role of authority in religion and communities and religion, than I think that certainly a lot of my colleagues do, and certainly most of my fellow parents do.
By the way, it's a very sweet dedication you said to my parents, who never gave up on me. I'm not quoting it exactly.
They always supported me. I'm an immigrant. And, you know, my parents came here because they were forced to after the revolution in Iran. And as all immigrant children will tell you, that it's hard to put into words the sacrifice that my parents made, not just in coming here, but in staying here so that I could have the opportunities that I have. It's very difficult to put that into words. Especially when then you tell your parents that what you want to do with their sacrifice is become a writer.
Not a doctor, not a lawyer.
Yeah, not a lawyer.
Engineer.
Not an engineer, but a writer. And it took them a while, but they accepted that and they supported it. And, you know, there's no way I could be who I am today and the life that I have today if it weren't for them.
Well, I'm glad they lived to see number one New York Times bestseller.
Thank you.
As a headline.
That did change things. Yeah. Once they realized, wait, you can actually make a living? Okay, well, I guess it's not so bad then.
This is In Good Faith. I'm speaking with Reza Aslan, author of No God But God. More with Reza Aslan. You can tell me how, if you're comfortable with this question or not. I don't know how this works in Islam necessarily, but I would love to ask you if you had the chance and could sit down and have a conversation with the Prophet Muhammad.
Oh, I love this question.
What would you ask? What would you hope? Or would you want to just follow him and see what he did for a day? Or would you say, can I ask you a few questions about...
How is it that nobody in 20 years has ever asked me this question before?
Well, I'm glad we get to
it. Yeah. You know, I love this question because as a scholar, I am primarily interested in questions of origins. That's why I write about Jesus, because I'm not interested necessarily in what Christianity became, but I'm interested in what Jesus thought. And I write about Islam, not because I'm interested in what Islam becomes as an institution, but because of how the Prophet Muhammad himself conceived of it. I guess, you know, it's about what came before. That's always what's fascinating to me. We have this idea that prophets arise in a vacuum. That's not how this works. Prophets are people who come from a particular community and society who are a product of their time and place. And so if you really want to know what a prophet meant, or why he said what he said, or where that idea even came from, then what you really need to know is about the world that he came out of, because that's where the idea came from. No matter how new or unique or interesting it is fundamentally a product of his world. And so with regard to the Prophet Muhammad, I write a lot about pre-Islamic Arabia and about the ideas that existed. And then I have to simply extrapolate the notion that Muhammad knew these ideas. Of course he did. Why wouldn't he know these ideas? And that he was aware of them, and then that he used them, massaged them, changed them, you know, saw them in a different way, with a different perspective, renewed them. That's what we now call Islam. So if I were to have a private moment, let's say, I think whatever questions I asked would all be about what you knew before all of this.
Interesting. You share an account of a very young Muhammad as a boy with a friend, Zaid.
Yeah, Zaid or Zaid. Mm.
And that they offer some food to someone who sort of upbraids them for, this was the food that was offered to all those idols. And that Muhammad is sort of really taken aback and deeply impressed, like, oh, I may have done something I shouldn't have, and kind of makes a choice.
Thank you for bringing up that. I love this story, and it's so foundational. That notion, that idea that a young Muhammad, long before the revelation, was chastised by a believer in a kind of pre-Islamic version of monotheism called Hanifism for having sacrificed meat to a god, an idol, it goes against everything that sort of traditional Islam says, which is exactly what I said, that prophets exist in a vacuum. They weren't affected by anyone. They were always perfect and sinless. And what's wonderful about that story, which is one of the earliest traditions, it exists, it's hard to ignore, it's there, and most Muslims ignore it and pretend it's not there, but it is. And it's that not only does it give us a glimpse into Muhammad's education, but it reminds us of a fundamental truth about prophethood as a vocation, which is that prophets do not invent religions. Prophets reform the religions out of which they arose. That a prophet is first and foremost a reformer. That Jesus didn't invent Christianity. Jesus reformed Judaism. He was a Jew, preaching Judaism to other Jews. The Buddha did not invent Buddhism. The Buddha was a Hindu. He was reforming Hindu. He didn't know what Buddhism was. He was a Hindu preaching Hinduism to other Hindus. And the same with the Prophet Muhammad, that he didn't invent Islam. In fact, most historians believe that no one called this thing Islam until long after the Prophet's death. The Prophet was an Arab preaching a new kind of Arab religiosity to other Arabs, but that religion was one that already existed in that vicinity. We can call it Hanifism or, you know, even Yahwehism. There's a lot of different terms for it, but it fundamentally challenges us to rethink the way that we envision these great religious figures of our past and to think of them, again, not as inventors of religion, but as reformers of religion.
You have a timeline that's just one or two pages that goes through with some major dates that bring the history of Islam all the way up to pretty close to now. In fact, 2023. To me, that was really useful to kind of place things historically. I just think it must be so frustrating to see a faith that gives you a connection to the divine or is a useful and honorable tradition hijacked by people who want to misuse it, and that they become the most famous adherents to Islam in the world.
Yeah. As a scholar, I try not to use terms like hijack because...
Yeah, and forgive me, maybe that was a really...
No, but actually I didn't even mean it in those terms, but that's pretty good. That's very good, Steve.
Well, yeah, you're making me think of multiple meanings, so...
No, anyway. What I mean by that is that doing so suggests that there are correct and incorrect interpretations of religion. And that's not really the case. Why do I say that? Well, because we have to remember this one very important point when we think about all religious traditions and religious people in general, is that oftentimes we feel as though religious people derive their values from their religion, that they open up their scripture. Their scripture presents ethics and morality, and then they adopt their own ethics and morality from that scripture. But that's not true. That's not how it works. The fact is that more often than not, religious people insert their values into their religions. They open up their scriptures, and rather than deriving values from it, they inject values into it. So, when you look at, and by the way, this is why, you know, you can have two people look at the exact same piece of scripture and walk away with two radically opposing interpretations of it, because scripture itself is fundamentally just words on a page. It requires an individual to interact with it so that then it can have meaning. But then that means that the meaning comes from the individual and not the text. So as much as I would love to say, as a believer, as a person of faith, that there are people who have taken this faith and transformed it into a religion of violence and misogyny and bigotry are wrong. I can't say that as a scholar, because the truth is they have taken their own misogyny, their own bigotry, their own violent tendencies, and they have injected into a neutral text. And that's where they derived their meaning. I have taken my pluralism, my desire for peace, my impulse for compassion, and I have injected those values into my scripture, and that's where I have derived my meaning. I can say that certain interpretations are less reasonable than other interpretations. But in the end, all interpretations are, by definition, valid interpretations. So my job isn't necessarily to lament the hijacking of Islam in the name of violence. My job is to combat what I see as a far less reasonable interpretation of my religion with a far more reasonable interpretation of it. I am of the belief, and this again comes from my, you know, experience as both a person of a faith and as a scholar of religions, that there really actually is no such thing as religion without culture, that they can't really point to a thing called Islam that exists in a vacuum outside of its interaction with culture. That oftentimes the question of how much of religion do we see that's cultural and how much isn't is a false dichotomy, because it's all, that none of it exists outside of culture. What I call Islam, as a upper middle class father in Los Angeles, bears very little resemblance to what, you know, an Egyptian fella calls Islam, what a Midwestern white Christian in Minnesota calls Christianity would be unrecognizable to what a coffee picker in Guatemala calls Christianity. Even the idea of Jesus, you know, the central figure of this religion, would be almost unrecognizable to each other. It's not that culture and religion interact and we can get to the core of religion by removing culture. Religion is culture, and they cannot be separated from each other.
Many thanks to Reza Aslan for speaking with me. This episode was produced by Heidi Clough. Our production team also includes Heather Bigley, Nick Levitt, and Ocean Marshall. Our post-production sound designer is Gabriel Haro. In Good Faith is committed to the idea that we all benefit from hearing people of widely varying backgrounds share their personal experience with faith and belief. In fact, we think people with such experience deserve some of our best listening. You can check out more of our episodes and extended interviews on our YouTube channel and connect with us on Instagram and Facebook at In Good Faith Podcast. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you join me again soon, right here in Good Faith.